On the Big App Show today, we've got an American hero, an American entrepreneur, and someone I'm very happy to have here in the studio. We have Rai Barkhat, who's written a fantastic book, It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. Welcome to the Big App Show. Nice to have you here. Really appreciate you coming.
Great to be here.
And off the bat, I want to say thank you for your service. Coming from a long line of service men and women, it's appreciated. We're more from the intelligence side, which is, but we all kind of fit together. I know what it's like, you know, how it affects families and personal life and stuff. This is your first book, but written over a long period of time throughout your relatively young life. I mean, you're born like 1979. I'm like, look at this guy. You know, he's like, hold on a second.
I just made the 70s.
Yeah, I didn't get to live the 70s either, really, the way you should have. You know, it's as I was reading this book, it's really two stories. Well, it's more than two, but two main stories interwoven into each other. The work you started with. I guess now is officially an NGO, a non-governmental organization, along with your service as a Marine. And the dichotomy of these two paths really makes for an interesting read. Do you maybe just want to explain a little bit about the book, and then I have a lot of questions for you.
Sure. I mean, that was the challenge of it, because when I started writing this 9 years ago as a second lieutenant in the Marines, it was really just a book about this place, Kibera, which is one of the larger slum communities in the world in Nairobi. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows how many people live there, somewhere between 200,000 to a million people. And I pitched that. I wrote a manuscript about 50,000 words, and I pitched it, and the response was deafening in its silence.
Why would we want to know about poor black people? You know, we don't want a book about that.
Yeah, that, and I finally got a response from someone, and she said, listen, not only is there sort of an issue with another book on Africa, so to speak, mm-hmm. but also you're missing something fundamental, and what you're missing is yourself. You need to put yourself into this. You need to personalize it. You need to, you know, you need to pour your soul into it. And I wasn't comfortable with that, because the heart and soul of our work in Kibera, and also to a certain extent the core ethos of the military, is to respect the power of small groups of individuals to make change. Not a single individual, not a citizen, mm-hmm. but groups of citizens. And so I didn't, and moreover, it's just difficult to do, you know, to put yourself out there in a way that is honest and accurate and has the failures and the setbacks as well as some of the triumphs. And so it took a long time and a lot of work.
Did you want to write the book because of the story you wanted to get out, or because you actually wanted to write? Was it like career change?
It was fundamentally about this particular story, mm-hmm. and a message. And the message is that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. It's the dedication of the book.
Right,
and
saw
that is true, I think, both in slum communities as well as in the United States and among our American men and women. What the book became was the blending of these two forms of service. And from a writing standpoint, it was particularly challenging, because in many ways it's a dueling narrative, as I experienced it in my own life, going through the Marines while also helping to build this NGO with a small group of committed Kenyans on the ground. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason it was challenging to write was because to process those two events while I was living them, I created mental compartments in my mind. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to shield the Marines from Kibera and vice versa. But what I realized only upon reflection later was that some of the moments of greatest insight happened when those two worlds clashed and converged.
Right.
And they're both conflicts as well as converging points. And you know what I found? We've been on tour now for about 6 weeks. We've been to 23 cities with a heavy outreach to colleges. Mm-hmm. And high schools, because that's really the audience that I wrote this for. And what I've found is that there is there's a lot of interest in this dichotomy, you know, what some see as waging peace while fighting war. And some people see that as a fundamental contradiction. I don't. I understand it, but I don't. I grew up in a family. My father was a Marine, and not career, but he had served in Vietnam. And he had deep reservations about my military service, because as defining as it was for him as an experience,
Well, as a parent, you're like, you don't want your kid to get messed up. Like, please.
That's for sure. Yeah, but also, you know, he fought in the Vietnam War, and mm-hmm. this was, in his opinion and in mine and so many others, an unjust war.
Our version of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so the American military fundamentally exists to promote a common defense, to promote peace, I believe. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it can't be misused, and I think that was a clear case of it in the Vietnam War, and to a certain extent also with Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so what I have tried to do in this book is be really honest with both the strengths as well as the severe limitations with the use of military force in different environments. And when I come back to that fundamental, what some people see as a contradiction of having these two worlds at the same time, you know, the way that I rationalized it, and the way that I still believe is accurate for those men and women who are on the front lines and who might not necessarily agree with particularly in, with Iraq, why we went there. I mean, the fundamental reasons why we went there have proved to be false. Mm-hmm. And that's just mm-hmm. the reality. That's true. The way that I rationalized that, though, was that the mission still mattered. You know, you were there in 2003. I was there in 2005, 2006. It was a dark time in the days of the Iraq War. The mission, though, still mattered, and that was to get out of that war as quickly and responsibly as possible, and with as little damage to American men and women in uniform and Iraqi civilians as possible. And
I believe that didn't quite work out exactly that way, but
yeah, well, it didn't. But I was there in 2005 and 2006 mm-hmm. in Fallujah. It wasn't working out.
But Fallujah was messed up.
Yeah, it was really You know, part of the reason why we had such great challenges were because the military lacks continuity. Hmm. You know, in Kibera, where we started this NGO 10 years ago, our work is all based on investing in young people's lives over a long trajectory, building relationships that are rooted in trust. But it's exceedingly difficult to do that when you're in an area, a complex area that's different from your own, mm-hmm. and you're leaving every 6 months. Or 12
well, not
months.
Only that, but you were literally in Fallujah, leading a group of Marines, commanding them, and then you get a satellite phone call from Kenya, and it's like I can't imagine being so focused on one mission and then having to segment. Oh, wait a minute, but I've got this whole other thing I'm doing, which is kind of, yeah, in a way the same, but completely opposite. I mean, how did you even function doing
all
that?
The key for me was that I didn't make many of those phone calls, but mm-hmm. they did happen.
Yeah.
You know, on a few times each week, and I really viewed our work in Kenya in the Kibera slum as a respite from the noise of combat, a way that I could directly impact some of the work that was happening on the ground.
What made you choose Kenya, Nairobi, specifically to help out 10 years ago? I mean, yeah. What was it that you made you choose that?
Well, you know, my father had served in the Marines, and so that was really my first calling. And I received an ROTC scholarship to go to school, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I knew that I was going to the Marines, so I wanted to be best prepared for the types of missions that we would face. Mm. And, you know, this was before September 11th. So
right.
I assumed that they would be of a Bosnia, Rwanda, albeit we intervened late there, but mm-hmm. but that they would be missions that had peacekeeping nature or interventions during ethnic strife. And I wanted to better understand why that happened in the world. And so I had a mentor who was an anthropologist, and she suggested that I look at Kibera because this slum community has a history of ethnic strife between different ethnic groups.
Right.
And so I arrived there. I'd taken some Swahili classes. I had learned some basic anthropology from professors, but also from my mother, who's an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that helps.
Yeah, it definitely helped.
Yeah.
And I respected that what they taught me was that in order to best understand something that's different from your own culture, you gotta, you know, immerse yourself into it.
Right.
And so I what I did was I sent a bunch of emails and eventually connected with a couple young people my age who let me share their 10x10-foot shacks in Kibera for a summer. And so I basically moved into Kibera for a very short period of time, mm-hmm. 5.5 weeks, and started forming relationships, friendships, really. I was asking young people about their lives to do this research project, but it wasn't long that I recognized this fundamental truth of the universality of talent. You know, talent's universal, opportunities not. And so the question then becomes, what role can you play as an outsider to help unlock some of that potential within a community like Kibera, or a community that's struck by violence in other parts of the world, the Middle East, the United States? How do you unlock that potential? And I think, and what I've endeavored to do by showing and not telling with the narrative of this book, is that it has to begin with a participatory approach. It has to begin with the recognition that that change can only happen if it's driven from the inside. It can't be imposed by the outside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a new idea or even a revolutionary idea, and it's not my idea, but it's an important one, and it's one that we so often lose sight of, as I believe, as members of the development community, but also at times, as a military.
Do you feel that Carolina for Kibera has made that type of difference? Do you feel that you've succeeded in a lot of those missions? It probably never ends, but you feel you've done
sure.
That?
I mean, what we try and do is we get a small amount of resources directly into the hands of the community. So when we started the organization off, we raised $20,000, and we use sports. I'm holding a soccer ball from the community. It doesn't take
much.
Is
that what that is?
Yeah.
A soccer ball.
This is a soccer ball. It's a bunch of plastic bags wrapped in twine.
Right.
It doesn't cost anything, really.
Right.
I mean, it's trash recycled. And so what we wanted to do was invest small amounts of resources directly into the hands of young leaders,
mm-hmm.
and help create role models from within the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that over the years. We've grown the organization to where it's at today. It's got about $1 million a year as a budget. That translates to about $20 per person.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 50,000 young people, largely, that are part of the organization. And where I see the change is not in the shantytown, not in the sewage that still runs open and some of the sheer deprivation of infrastructure, but where I see the change is in the lives of the young people that are affected by the organization, role models within the community, young men and women that now have self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
and that are looked up to. There are a lot of examples. I think one of the most compelling from my life is really the heroine of the book,
mm-hmm.
Tabitha Festa,
yeah,
who was my co-founder. And
now it's really beautiful how you set that up, and I don't know if a lot of our European viewers may not know exactly how the ROTC works, which is kind of interesting, very unique, I think, to the United States, where you get a scholarship, you go to school. This is actually a lot of what the DREAM Act is about now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that you're going to be doing like your weekend, once every three weeks, you go off to camp, you train, etc. Did you ever consider when you, and of course you were happy to go to school and have that paid for by the government, did you ever consider that you would wind up in Fallujah, like fighting for your life possibly because of that choice you made?
Yeah, well, what I have tried to do with this book is also show the effects of violence on the human spirit and some of these bizarre things that happen that many of us who have served feel. And one of those things is the attraction to the experience itself, the attraction to combat. And it wasn't something that happened instantly. It wasn't something that I really recognized when I first decided to sign up for the Marines and they paid for my school, and in return I owed them 8 years of service. But I sought that, and especially after 9/11. I mean, Marines want to be on the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be serving righteous battles in some ways. And I was too numb to the circumstances in some points to really understand what was happening to myself psychologically as I was going through these experiences. And the process of writing the book years later helped me really go into those and explore them in an honest and I hope accurate way. And what I recognized was just some fundamental truths about our own humanity and the spectrum, frankly, that lies between good and evil, and how fragile that can become in certain circumstances.
There's so many boys and girls coming back now from Afghanistan, from Iraq, who are pretty messed up, which I think is really being hidden from the certainly from the United States, from the citizens of the United States. How when, going through what you went through, I mean, how has that really affected you? I mean, did the book really help get a lot of load off of your shoulders? I mean, it seems like the stuff you went through, you can't just come back and be unaffected. You know, absolutely. But you seem pretty together.
Well. You know, my experiences were nowhere near as intense and severe as many of those on our front lines, but they affected me in a deep way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found to be most difficult was the violence on the lives of other young people. It wasn't long after I arrived to Fallujah that I wasn't seeing kids for kids.
Right.
You know, I was seeing kids as part of potentially an enemy apparatus, and I'd be looking at their waistlines for concealed weapons, their hands for grenades. You know, in one of the moments within Fallujah, I interviewed an assassin, mm-hmm. and he had killed the chairman of the Fallujah City Council, and he's 11 years old.
Yeah. You
know, 11 years old, and that rips me up, and it still does. And imagine what it does for the kids that are actually affected by this violence, both American men and women, but also mm-hmm. civilians in these circumstances. I don't think there's really any easy solution. I do believe that it requires reflection, and reflection doesn't just happen for many. It has to be. There has to be a structure for it. You have to have time to do it. Mm-hmm. The book gave me that, but I was also fortunate to be able to go to graduate school, to have extraordinary mentors, to have folks in my life like my father who had also been through the experience of combat. I mean, in many respects, no one really gets it unless they've sort of seen it or been in it. And I think that part of the reason why veterans are so reticent to speak about it is because it's so large, it's so all-consuming, that if you're talking about this experience with somebody who hasn't had it, it's like you're in some way speaking a different language.
Yeah, it's impossible to really understand. Yeah, well, I'd say with my family, no one really talks about stuff.
Yeah,
even amongst each other.
Even like, amongst
yeah,
each other.
Whatever, you know, it's what it is. Yeah.
I mean, you know, in my dad's case, Vietnam vet was shot in the face, severely wounded. You know, he was, he found the opportunities very few and far between to actually engage. He never really spoke about the war with me until I was about to go off on my own, and he wrote me a manuscript about his experience in Vietnam.
Wow.
Which was very powerful for me to read beforehand. But for him, it was really the very few friends that he has that have endured over the years are his friends from the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are moments where they're able to go back and sort of try and make sense of those
right.
experiences. So, I mean, what I have tried with this thing is to really take readers into what transpired, you know, and to write a book that has the pacing so that the pages still move, so that it can reach a mainstream audience. But for those readers who are more discerning, who are looking for more reflection about some of these very heavy issues,
mm-hmm.
About the use of force and when we use force and the effects of violence, that they have a narrative here that they can latch on to and hopefully apply to their own circumstances.
I mean, this is a great book for young people, people just going into college. I also think every congressman and senator should read it. They might think twice about some of the decisions they make.
You know, one thing that it's interesting. I mean, I thank you for that. We hope that it will help inform a smarter approach, and an approach that fundamentally recognizes that you can't, you know, kill and capture your way out of an insurgency, which the military now gets better than most,
right.
You know, and you know, General Petraeus and others are some of the most forceful advocates for this. So I mm-hmm. think, you know, when I think about Washington, you know, I was a junior officer in the Marines, so I'm speaking out of my rank here, but I think that if I was going to give advice to a congressperson, it would be this. It would be that, you know, in order to have a more peaceful and secure world and to really do justice to our American men and women in uniform, you got to keep investing in the other soft power tools that are at our disposal, mm-hmm. our development, our diplomacy initiatives. They're not perfect. They can still use work, but that is a crucial part of our national security.
Yeah, it's inspirational. It really is, and again, I recommend people read this book because it really, there's a couple of things. One is it's inspirational for what you're doing in Kibera. It's inspirational as an American who wants to do something for other people, and also if you saw the Hurt Locker. Not really. I was like, please. You know, I think this book really takes you to a whole different place that is a lot more real.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll just make a comment on that, on the Hurt Locker. Mm-hmm. I thought that the cinematography was spectacular, but I really had issues, and so many of my fellow veterans had issues yeah. with this main character,
yeah.
Who would have been, in my unit, mm-hmm. He would have been out of that country immediately
yeah. Yeah.
From some of the behavior that he exhibited. So it just, I don't know why they didn't make it more accurate because they really had an opportunity to do. They did a wonderful job with the stress and the strain and the uncertainty of that moment.
Well, that's what Hollywood does, right? They do the tension well.
The tension
but then,
well.
Ooh, facts, you know.
Or the character, you yeah. know, the main character yeah. development. They had such a great opportunity there to make that character realistic.
Yeah.
And that's what I've tried to do in this book.
Oh, you
really
hit home, totally hit home. So what's next? You're out promoting the book, obviously, to
yeah.
get people to read it.
To read it, and we're out to colleges in particular, but we've been to 23 cities in the United States, and we'll be out for another about 2 months. We're going to launch the book globally out of the UK, in July. Yep. And then we head to Kibera in Nairobi for the finale, and we'll launch the book on the ground in the community.
And for you personally, more writing?
Yeah, you know, I hope that writing will always be a part of my life. Mm-hmm. I am now made. I'm 32 years old. Married, just starting a family in Charlotte, North Carolina.
You got kids yet? Or
yeah,
congratulations.
Fact, thank you. Yeah, our daughter turns one, as a matter of fact, coming up.
Mine is about to turn 21, and well, sleep is over.
Yeah.
Just about the time when the kids are sleeping, then you're awake because where's the damn kid? You know, it's not home yet. This will be a journey, my friend. You'll enjoy this one.
No doubt. I mean, we talk a lot about leadership in this book, in the Marines, in Kibera, but I mean, everybody who's a parent knows about leadership, and it really starts with the example that you set and how you live your life.
Totally, totally. Yeah. Ry, I really appreciate you coming in. It's so
great
nice.
To be here.
Good luck with the book. And again, everyone, go out and get it if you want it right now. Very simple. Just tap on the big blue button after the video's over. You can take it to the Amazon store. You can buy it from there. Good luck, and hope to see you again with your next project. And we'll keep an eye out and help where we can.
Thank you so much, and thank you, listeners, and please help us get this story into the hands of other young doers. Appreciate it.